This podcast is sponsored by Great White Hot Sauce. It's a small batch, handmade hot sauce made specially for you. So if you like hot sauce, you'll love Great White Hot Sauce. It's the hot sauce that bites back. Find it at www.trygreatwhite.com. Well, here we are, episode 78. And on this episode, we're going to do some Did You Knows? Me and Jack. Jack and I. Jack and Diane. But don't call me Diane, because that's not my name. But Jack does sometimes. It's kind of strange. Anyways, yeah, we have some good Did You Know stuff. And some trivia. Things like that. So sit back. Enjoy the show.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
The KOFB studio presents Milk Crates and Turntables, a music discussion podcast hosted by Scott McLean. Now, let's talk music. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, Amanda, for that wonderful introduction as usual. Good thing Amanda recorded that before she went off to college, right? Or I'd have to say that every episode. Anyways, welcome to the podcast. You know the name, I'm not going to say it. We're streaming live right now over YouTube, Facebook, Twitch, DLive, and the new and improved, better than ever, Twitter. I held it. Yeah, better than ever. But you know who's not better than ever? Because he's always the best. My friend Jack Calabrese.
Howdy, Scott.
Hey. All right, enough of that. Okay.
What's going on, man?
What's up, my brother? My brother.
My brother. What's going up, man? Pleasantries, a far cry from our exchange on Facebook.
People. I don't know what people think about that stuff. I don't know if it makes them uncomfortable. What? Well,
there's got to be like no question that people like I know that there are some aspects of the world that they're on maybe polar opposites. So I don't know if this is real or not. But it is kind of fun.
Oh, it's always fun. It's always fun. It's one of those you know, how things are written, how things are read, we are so beyond that.
Yeah.
So beyond that. It just doesn't even matter. But welcome back. Welcome back. We were off last week. I was cheating on this podcast. I was working on another podcast. Just horror stories. Yeah. About to release another episode. Yeah.
Dude, you're already plugging your other shows?
Why not?
We're two minutes into this and you're already plugging other shows?
Why not? How's this? Jack sells paintings. If you want one of Jack's paintings, he's really good painting guy. He's a good painter. So there you go. I'm plugging Jack's paintings. Is that the name of his show?
Yeah, that's it. Jack's paintings. You know, recently I've had a couple of people who are like, hey, I'd like you to paint this for my husband's 50th birthday. And I say, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're like, what do you mean? No, I thought you were a painter. I was like, yeah, I'm a painter, but I paint for me. I don't give two flying fucks about, you know, your husband or his 50th birthday or whatnot. I'm sure it's great and everything like that. But, you know, painting commissions, it's a lot. It's a challenge, right? There's a lot of pressure.
There is. I would think so. I would think that if something doesn't look according to what their expectations were, there's that.
Yeah, you know, I'm afraid that I would get comments like, geez, I thought it would be a lot more blue. And I'd be like, here, let me put my fist through it.
I was like, here's your fucking check back. I'll take my painting. Guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to paint it blue. That's what I'm going to do.
That's right, you goddamn sons of bitches.
Little boy blue. He needed the money. Oh.
Dude, really? We're doing other people's bits?
I know. Like James Corden stole Ricky Gervais's thing the other night. What a scum.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he stole a Ricky Gervais joke from like 2018. Yeah, and he got called out for it. And he's like, oh, I made a mistake. I didn't know it was Ricky's joke. Blah, blah, blah. Fucking hack.
Well, I mean,
so
was
many
it
hacks
was it,
out there?
Was it word for word? I mean, look, if you.
It was just about word for word.
That's one of the things that like, for like a half second, I thought it would be really interesting to try to go to an open mic night and just try it once. Not, I don't think that I'm the funniest guy in the world. I just thought it would be an interesting experience. How does a comedian know what material has already been done? You know, what observations have been made? I mean, there's got to be a little bit of a challenge. It's almost like a number of times on this show, we've actually talked about songs that have been plagiarized or maybe thought to have been plagiarized.
So Lou Colicchio, right, who sits in from the Music Relish podcast, he spoke on that. He said him and Perry Dedovich, they write music. And Lou actually, he came clean. He goes, I have a hard time writing music because I feel like I'm stealing it from somebody, even if he gets the slightest idea.
Yeah, you know, there was a story out there, and I can't remember if it was yesterday or Hey Jude, but Paul McCartney was rocking around going, do you know this song? Have you heard this song? Not quite sure, even himself, the great, legendary, iconic, masterful songwriter, you know, Paul McCartney, just didn't know.
See, that's a good segue into did you knows. You just gave us a good did you know. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got one.
All right.
Yeah. Some of these you might have already know, but this is a did you know thing. This is a pretty simple one. Did you know that Axl Rose used to earn $8 an hour by smoking cigarettes for a science experiment at UCLA?
is that what happened to his voice?
Yeah. Welcome to the jungle. I got my cigarette. No, that's the beginning of Sweet Leaf. That's actually should have been in great intros. I don't know, maybe it was.
Yeah, come on, one of the best.
Oh, absolutely. For Sabbath fans.
Do you remember the first time you heard that? I was a kid. I was like, what the fuck is this?
Did you know that was the first album that I ever owned of my own? See, my father used to come with milk crates, hence the name of the podcast, milk crates full. He gave us like six, and I've told this story before, six milk crates. So that's what, like 50 albums at least?
Yeah.
So he gave us like six milk crates of albums, right? So me and my brothers would kind of pick through them, and that's where I had like Rick Wakeman, Journey to the Center of the Earth, that you laughed at me about. But it was in these collections because when you opened the gatefold to some of these, it said property of Jim. But Black Sabbath, Master of Reality was the first album that was ever just mine, not mine and my brother's.
Ah.
So Sweet Leaf was my favorite song off of that because that intro was so epic.
So
it was like 12, by the way.
first albums, like, does it count if somebody bought it for you, but it was your first album?
No, it doesn't. No, that was a gift. It was a gift to, this is your album. Yeah.
My first album that I owned was, there were two, kind of polar opposites from one another. Tommy by The Who,
okay,
which I brought to show and tell in like kindergarten or first grade.
Yeah.
And Ben by Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson, the 45.
That's right. No. It was the album.
Oh.
It was the album. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Those. That's.
I was. I was a big MJ fan. Even when I was a kid, I was a big MJ fan. He touched me.
I was somewhat, like I said, I was all hooked up into Bowie when I was a young kid. I really was just like,
well, I'm not sure that I discovered Bowie that early. I'm talking about,
yeah,
like I own the Michael Jackson record. I remember getting it. I got it at the Singing Cricket.
Yeah.
In downtown Winthrop, Massachusetts. I think I was 5 or 6. So, you know, Bowie didn't come into my world for a couple more years.
Right. Although the first song I remember playing on an album, I had to be 5. I think I had the record player, and I've told this story before, the suitcase record player. And I just took an album and I put it on there and I dropped that plastic needle in the crackling, right? I'm being dramatic, but this is how it sounded. And the intro to House of the Rising Sun was my first experience in hearing a record being played that I played myself. I didn't know the song.
Like the traditional version or the Animals version?
No, the Animals version. The Animals version.
Great song. One of the great vocal performances of all time.
Eric Burdon, such a fucking great voice. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I know we always go in that road. We always end up on that road. But
the Animals aren't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I don't think so. Are they?
I would bet $100 right now that the Animals are absolutely in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
They should be. All right.
Which, by the way, the induction ceremony is Saturday.
Is it?
Yeah.
Ah, I didn't know that. Yes. I haven't been paying attention to that. What are the, do you have the list?
I don't even remember. It's been so long. I do remember that Pat Benatar is in there. Which, by the way, I love Pat Benatar. But do you want to hear something stupid?
Well, I mean, I talk to you a lot.
I'm sure it's well intentioned. But do you know the song "Hit Me with Your Best Shot" by Pat Benatar?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know that she will not play that song anymore?
It's a good, did you know? See that? You're just pulling them off.
Do you know why?
I don't know
she,
why.
Do you know why she know doesn't? Why. She says that she doesn't do it in protest of gun violence.
What a fucking, Jesus.
I was going to go out and buy a gun today, but I heard what Pat Benatar was doing and it persuaded me to.
But I did hear that she did give them the rights. She gave Moderna the rights for the COVID shot.
Oh, God.
She gave Moderna the, get it? Hit me with your best shot.
I'm picking up my guitar.
Ah, there we go. Come on, that was good. That was clever. But imagine seeing that commercial. Hit me with Moderna holding up a fucking needle. Hit me with a COVID vaccine. Hit me with your best shot. All right, I think it's funny. All right, I think.
Yeah, it's very clever.
London Calling. Do you know where that phrase came from? I would think that you would know.
What from?
London Calling, the song.
The World War II broadcasts.
Right.
London Calling.
Good morning, America. This is London Calling.
Yeah.
Yep. Kind of figured you know that, but maybe some of the listeners did.
I'm a big, big Clash guy. I loved that band.
Greatest album. One of the greatest album covers of all time. It has London to be Calling. In the top 10. Yes.
Yeah.
Did you know how that picture came about?
Well, they originally weren't going to use it because it was out of focus.
There was like this lady was their photographer and she said she took about 100 pictures, right? And they just, Joe Strummer was just popping like, and she put the good ones at the top and the ones she didn't think were good at the bottom type scenario. And he's just doling them out like cards. And he goes, this is the one. She's like, it's from the side of the stage and it's, this is the one. And that's
Paul Simon on breaking his bass.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. It's fucking great. And with the Elvis, the Elvis kind of lettering.
Kind of the Elvis font.
Yeah. That was, that was actually a ripoff of one of his album covers, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think maybe his first album, wasn't it?
Yeah. This is Elvis or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what else?
So guess what I'm doing Friday night?
You going to a concert?
I'm not going to a concert. Kinda, I guess I'm going to a concert or whatnot. So today, actually not today, yesterday. Today's the second, right? Yesterday was the release of Bono's.
Oh, that's right.
Memoir.
Yeah, yeah,
Surrender. You know, 40 songs, one story, or something like that. And so that Bono is playing. He's actually doing a book tour. And I guess this book tour is a combination, and quite honestly, I'm not 100% sure if I'm right on this. It's going to be part him reading excerpts of the book. I think he's being interviewed. He'll probably take some questions from the audience, and he's going to do a couple of songs. Okay. So he's playing at the, or appearing, I should say, at the Orpheum. He's at the Beacon Theater tonight, and I've actually already heard from a friend stating that the Ed showed up tonight. I don't know if that's true. It's just what I was told. So I don't know if he's accompanying Bono on this trek or if it was just a one night thing where he, but I can tell you one thing, that there were a bunch of tickets floating around for Friday night and the ticket prices were starting to come down a little bit, you know, the whole verified Ticketmaster resale, the ticket prices were coming down. And when I heard that, the Edge had showed up at the Beacon, I went on to the Ticketmaster site, and the ticket prices have now skyrocketed.
Really?
Where people are thinking that it's going to be at least half a U2 show. I think a lot of people may be disappointed that it may be a one-off. But that's not the reason why I mention it. The reason I mention it is that I have a seat that's pretty close to the stage. Shocking. I'm going with a buddy from Winthrop, Tim Miner, and I have a couple of U2 rabid crazy fans that I know are going as well. And in the event that there is an opportunity where they do take questions from the audience, I'm thinking that if I'm fortunate enough to be selected, of doing two things, and I haven't quite figured out how to phrase it, but one of them is going to be that this is Bono's first return to the Orpheum Theater since they played in 1983. Show that Deb and I, the lovely Deb, the lovely Miss Deb, and I was thinking that I was going to say, Bono, I don't know if this place holds special feelings for you, but I wanted to just share with you, speaking that you had just brought up the Clash, that my wife and I, my wife of 29 years, we're both at this show, and I was going to actually hold up, and I still have it, Deb's actual Clash shirt that she wore and held up Bono in 1983. And I was going to say thank you for all of the memories as far as my wife and I being big U2 fans and big concert fans. And then I was going to say the other thing I want to do is to criticize you and assault you. Because almost that same very year, you appeared at the Worcester Centrum. And one thing that you probably don't remember is that you held up, or my friend held you up,
jumped,
had you on his shoulders. And much like the 30 plus years of being with my wife, I have heard this fucking story
from him.
For 30 years, none of us realizing when he had climbed off that stage, once having you on his shoulders, that he would be the high water mark of his life.
If you got that recorded, I would, that would be,
you know what? Yeah. You know, it would be a miracle if that all played out the way that it would just be hilariously funny if it played out that way. Unfortunately, even if it does play out that way, this is going to be one of those shows where you have to give up your cell phone before you enter the venue.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They have those little, you know, bags with the combinations and whatnot, but they are not allowing any phones into the venue.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. You know what? I got to be honest with you. I kind of like it. I don't like the inconvenience that I know that I'm going to have to go through. I'm actually considering just leaving my phone in the car.
Yeah.
So I don't have to wait. But you know what? I think it's going to be very, very refreshing to be at a show where I don't have to look at the 50 fucking mini screens in front of me.
So touching on that, you know, my stepson and I went to see Gorillaz last week.
Yeah.
It was the last show of the world tour in Miami. And I happened to, and we're always on the left side of the stage, you know, always about the same distance, about 15 yards away, because the floor is always standing room, right? And he came over and he leaned over and looked into the crowd, and I caught a picture. I took a picture of him looking into the crowd, and then there's a cell phone in the bottom right-hand corner. Then you see his full picture in the cell phone. You know what I mean? I just thought it was a good contrast as to kind of what it is now. And I kind of made it a point. It's hard not to. I made it a point to not maybe video as much as I have in the past, just to enjoy it. I do enjoy it. And it was, according to my stepson and I, their best show that we've seen, and we've seen him three times. He was trashed. He was shit-faced.
Oh, really?
Oh, he was shit-faced. Yeah. Yeah. He started playing one song, and all of a sudden he stopped. He goes, stop. And the band just stops. Like, and he is, sometimes you just have to rewind. He was holding the wrong mic. You know, he has that handheld, and it sounds like this.
Yeah.
And he didn't, he started singing. My stepson was like, I thought he was supposed to sing like a verse earlier. And he caught himself and he's like, ah, what the hell? Start again. And they just, I never saw that. I've never seen that in a concert. But it was their last show. They were like, what the hell? What the hell? But moving on. Did you know that Brian Jones, co-founder of the Rolling Stones, was proficient at over 60 musical instruments. Proficient in 60 instruments. What the fuck?
They said that you could put anything in front of him and he'd be able to play it.
Jesus.
I think that's probably a little bit of a stretch.
Can you name 60 instruments?
Yeah, the didgeridoo, the oboe, the bassoon.
Yeah. The Alps bow, whatever it was.
The Alps bow, the triangle.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. You know, 60 instruments, the triangle's got to be in there somewhere.
The cowbell.
Oh, my God.
I'm proficient in cowbell.
Oh, my God. Did you hear Brian play the triangle? Woo!
See? I'm proficient. See? I'm proficient in one instrument. You fucking musicians. Fuck all of you. Fuck you, Mark Smith, Luke Alicchio. Fuck all of you. Guitar players, drummers, whatever. All right, give me a did you know.
I don't have any did you knows. I came to the show completely unprepared tonight.
You are such a fucking... Stop that. Stop.
Sorry. Sorry.
Turn it around. Let's see. Who was the first band to ever advertise a new album on a billboard?
Oh, that's a good one. I'm going to guess the Beach Boys.
No, but same state, around the same location. The Doors.
Oh, yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, I believe it was on Sunset Strip. You ever been to Sunset Strip?
Sure.
I had an Asian hooker tell me I was fine on Sunset Strip. Yeah.
What did that cost you?
Nothing. Nothing. I just walked on by me and my buddies. Yeah.
Well, I do have a question for you, and I don't know if I asked you this in a previous show or not. And it's not a did you know, but I guess, do you know which rock band or artist has released the most albums over the span of their career.
Which rock band or artist has released the most albums over a span of their career? Or artist. You can go. I'm not even going to go with the typical answer. It has to be somebody outside the box.
Is somebody that's kind of slightly outside of the box. Yeah. If you went into the record store, this artist's stuff was way at the end.
What genre?
I think that you would consider him to be rock, but he definitely ventured into instrumentals and even orchestral.
I don't know. Ooh.
Wait a minute. Think about the hint that I gave you. If you went into a record store, you'd
Barry
have to
White.
Go all no. a little bit further. The record store, the records are lined up what? Alphabetically?
Oh, so you're going down to Z, W, X, Y, Z. I'm missing it.
Z, you idiot! Z!
ZZ Top. Oh, God. Lauren Zevon.
ZZ Top. Multi-instrumentalist. You know, ventured into orchestral. ZZ Top. You giant moron.
You are an idiot.
Frank Zappa.
That's why I was never a Frank Zappa fan. Never.
Yeah, but this is a controversial question. I will give you that. So Frank Zappa released 109 albums.
That's crazy.
109 albums, only to be surpassed. And the only reason why I didn't give this guy top billing was because you're moving into the digital era and whatnot. You know the artist Buckethead?
Yeah, he was. He played with Guns N' Roses.
Guns N' Roses.
He played with Korn. I saw him play with Korn.
Yep.
Yeah.
He has 302 releases to his name.
Jesus. Albums?
302. And then on the country side, guess
who? And he's made $302 on all of them.
I know. So it's just like, remember when the Blair Witch Project came out? Yeah. Chris Rock said he was like, the Blair Witch Project cost $60,000 to make. He was like, I don't know, but somebody's walking around with $59,000 in their pocket.
That's great. Hey, look, Perry Dinovich, the host, the mastermind of Music Relish Podcast. He says, did you know that Brian Jones played saxophone on the Beatles? You know my name. Look up the number. Yeah.
That's pretty Perry's cool. Amazing.
Yeah.
He knows That's pretty cool.
His stuff. Perry knows a lot of obscure stuff to it.
So let me finish.
He's
so
a bot. He's still a bot.
We were talking about, you know, rock music. What about in the country genre? Who released the most albums on the country side of the world?
Glen Campbell.
No.
Willie Nelson.
Johnny Cash.
I was going to say Johnny Cash, but it seemed too obvious.
Well, and it is a little bit bullshit in that Johnny Cash has 167 releases to his name, 109 of them being compilation records.
That's what I mean. That just seemed too obvious that he would be like saying, most people would say the Rolling Stones had the most albums of the Beatles because they're the biggest bands, which what we're proving is not necessarily do you have to be the biggest band to produce the most albums.
I think the Rolling Stones came in at like a lowly 29 albums.
Yeah. Lowly. Yeah. Yeah.
A lowly classic 29 albums. But there are other bands like the Melvins and the Residents that have, you know, hundreds of releases, you know, but there is such a thing as quality control.
Exactly.
You know, just because you can release 302 albums, it doesn't mean you should.
Yeah. I'm sure there's somebody that's somewhere out in the digital world that is well on their way to releasing. And what is an album? Is it five songs? Is there a minimum on an album?
I don't know.
Right?
But I bet you that person that's going to release that new record may be Perry Dedovich.
There you go. There you go. Hey, did you know that Aerosmith refused to fly on the plane that later crashed with the members of Lynyrd Skynyrd on it?
Yes, I did know that.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty creepy. On October 20th, 1977, Convair 240 crashed outside Gillsburg. You know, again, we know what that was. A few months earlier, Aerosmith had hired someone to inspect the same plane and were talked out of using it. In an interview with Crave Online, Aerosmith guitarist Joe Perry mentions this incident, but he doesn't give details on why they refused to fly the plane, saying only, "Fortunately, we had someone looking at the plane that we would be taking, and he put his foot down and said, no fucking way am I getting on that plane, basically." So they were like, all right, dude, we'll listen to you. Creepy.
Creepy.
Yep. Let's see. Speaking of releasing music, did you know that Van Morrison recorded 31 useless songs to fulfill a rec contract?
That sounds like something Van Morrison would do.
So the story goes, in 1967, Van Morrison started his solo career with Bang Records and legendary producer Burt Burns. It was with Bang that Morrison recorded the hit single Brown Eyed Girl, and the song appeared on his debut album, Blowing Your Mind. The problem was, Burns never told Morrison he was making the album. Morrison wasn't happy, and after Burns perished unexpectedly at the end of 1967, and I think the end of this little thing tells why he perished, the musician was ready to jump ship with Bang. Warner Brothers Records was happy to sign Morrison, but before he could stop making music, he was contractually obligated to write 36 songs for his former label. And so in a move as petulant as it was bold, and you have said he is quite the petulant guy, right?
Yes.
He can be very moody. Morrison cranked out 31 deliberately terrible songs for Bang.
Is one of them Brown Eyed Girl?
Oh, Jesus, right? Listening to them now, and you should, they seem to have been made up. They've been made up and recorded all on the spot with an obviously bored Morrison strumming an increasingly out-of-tune guitar. This session has been dubbed Morrison's Contractual Obligation Album and sometimes called Paying Dues. Now, despite Morrison's audacity, this recording session was not enough to release him from his contract. Warner Brothers executive Joe Smith claims he had to bring a sack full of money in the amount of $20,000 in cash to a group of gangsters in a Manhattan warehouse to end it all. So getting back to Burt Burns, you know where he went? He fucked them over. Fucked over the mob. So, yeah, that's the Van Morrison 31 useless songs. I'd like to hear those. They got to be a fucking riot to listen to.
Oh, yeah.
Now I know in the backstory. Kind of sounds like you in the background of the music, Milk Crates and Turntables podcast. Right? That just out-of-tune guitar. No?
Wow. Hey, man, I'm just sitting here trying to fulfill my contractual obligation.
Absolutely.
Did you know?
Come on, no words. You can't come up with words like Van Morrison did on the spot. That's a song.
My manager, Bob, burned the mob.
Yeah. Bob burned the mob. Yeah. And the mob burned him, literally. Did you know that before going on stage with his group, Depeche Mode, Dave Gahan used to take naps in a coffin?
God.
During Depeche Mode's devotional tour, lead singer Dave Gahan was going through a vampire phase. This is the 90s. As a joke, a coffin was delivered to him while he was touring in South America, and he'd allegedly take naps in it from that point on before the shows.
I would imagine it would have been quite peaceful in there.
He evidently had a bed the shape of a coffin too. So, I don't know.
I never realized that Depeche Mode and Dave Gahan was, you know, such a emo, gothy type guy.
You didn't really? The early stuff you can see.
I get it, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The early stuff, it was, they were kind of like dark wave. They had a dark wave-ish sound to them. So did you know the Beach Boys bought a song from Charles Manson?
Yes, I did know that.
Okay. Do you know the story?
I know a little bit of the story, but you're going to tell me anyway.
Okay, in the summer of 68, Dennis Wilson befriended the charismatic ex-convict named Charles Manson, blah, 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 you know, his reputation. Wilson actually got Manson recording time in his brother's studio. It did not go well. And even bought the rights to one of his songs, the Beach Boys did. They bought, it's called Cease to Exist. Apparently, Manson sold the song for a one-off cash payment and a motorcycle. But Manson didn't approve of Wilson changing some of the lyrics and sent him a single bullet as a warning. Right? So the Beach Boys changed the name of Manson's song to Never Learn Not to Love, and Manson was not given a songwriting credit. And then in 1976, when asked about his relationship with Manson and his family, Wilson said, as long as I live, I will never talk about that.
Oh, God. Well, wasn't there some theory behind, you know, the murders that were committed that he was actually chasing after a manager or a producer affiliated with the Beach Boys that had made some promises?
Could be. Yeah. Could be. What was the Quentin Tarantino movie that just came out a few years back?
Was it Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, yeah. Yeah, it's an alternate world. He's great at those alternate endings, like what if this happened the other way, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But great movie.
Yeah, long movie.
But it was a great story, right? I mean, Brad Pitt stole every scene.
Yeah.
He just stole every fucking scene. But then again, Leonardo DiCaprio, I mean, I think he got nominated. He might have got nominated, but he played a great role also. I mean, it was just a good movie. I watched the scene with Brad Pitt playing the stuntman fighting Bruce Lee in the back lot. Okay, Kato. Did you know about... I found some things on curses. Did you know there was a Fleetwood Mac's guitarist curse? Supposedly.
That Fleetwood Mac guitar players were like injured?
Well, yeah, or something always happened. So Fleetwood Mac has been through so many guitarists that this is less of a curse as it is an inevitability. The group founded by guitarist Peter Green, who left the band to deal with his mental health, then slide guitarist Jerry Spencer left soon after. In 72, guitarist Danny Kirwan started acting bizarrely during a gig and on the eve of their tour, smashed his head on a wall and then taunted the band from the audience and Oasis in the Gallagher Brothers style. He later passed after extensive issues with mental illness. Recently, guitarist Bob Weston suffered a fatal aneurysm in 2012, and later that same year, guitarist Bob Welch ended his life after receiving news that he would never walk again.
Wow.
It's kind of weird, right? You never really hear that stuff. It is kind of weird.
No.
Yeah, nope. Lindsey Buckingham survived.
Who, by the way, is a great guitar player.
Oh, isn't he, though? Yeah, in his own way, his own style. Yeah. His very unique style. Sound. Unique sound. What about the white lighter curse?
The white lighter curse.
Yeah.
I don't think I know the white lighter curse.
All right. Well, a common myth says that anyone who uses a white lighter is cursed, possibly to the end. But that does, let me see, but what does this have to do with music? Well, did we mention that Kurt Cobain, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison were all found with a white lighter on them when they died?
Really?
Yeah. Kind of fucking weird, too.
Fascinating. Yeah, that is. It's a little strange.
What are the odds, though? I mean, think about it. What are the odds? And they all died at 27, right? Yeah.
But I guess in some sense, it kind of makes sense. I'm just trying to think about that for a second. Musicians spend a lot of time in the dark. You know, concerts, backstage and whatnot. Maybe that's why they all use a white lighter.
I don't know. It might be a reach, but hey, who's to say?
Who knows?
Maybe it was a rock and roll thing. Let me see. Perry Dietovich says, did you know? No, you already did that. Okay. I don't know why I'm looking at that differently. Okay. John Lennon and the number 9. You know all the crossovers?
He was kind of obsessed with that, right? So, I mean, but wasn't he born on the 9th?
So he was born on the 9th of October in Liverpool, and his band was fortuitously discovered on the 9th of November, 61. The Beatles played on the Ed Sullivan Show on the 9th of February, 67. February. Lennon February. Met Yoko Ono. Well, the spelling right here says February. I'm just looking at the spelling. Lennon met Yoko Ono on the 9th of November, 66. All of those things sound pretty good, but then things start to take a darker turn. The Beatles broke up after spending 9 years together, and sadly, Lennon was shot and killed on December 8th, 1980. But in Liverpool, where he was born, the date was December 9th.
That's a little bit of a stretch.
I don't know. He was born over there, so I think I can get because he wasn't shot during the day. Right? It could have happened anytime during the day, but it was at night. And London's, 6 hours ahead of us?
Yeah. I think that's a little bit of a stretch. I'm sorry.
So was fucking, musicians and rock stars with white lighters in the dark. I mean, I didn't give you the bullshit. That's a little bit of a stretch. Whoa. Little bit of a stretch, yeah.
So not for nothing. The white lighter theory was complete bullshit.
It's a fact. All those dudes were found in Janis Joplin with a white lighter on.
I believe that. I'm not saying
it's just
that.
A curse.
I'm saying my theory in terms of why they were using white lighters was completely made up.
Completely made up. I know. Hey, Mark Smith said, did you know that Mark Smith has the worst record in trivia on milk crates and turntables?
I heard he's 0-9.
He doesn't answer the question right and. He gets the funny thing.
You know the funny thing is he's probably fucking smarter than all of us.
Let me see. Mark Smith says, hey, Jack brought in Tommy for show and tell. I brought in my sister's copy of Brain Salad Surgery. The teachers wanted to know if everything was okay at home. Today you would be evaluated. They'd put you on medication. You'd be put in a safe spot. There'd be a lot of stuff done to you today.
Yeah, but Mark, try to top this one. You know, my parents had gotten a hold of my copy of Tommy, and when I brought mine in, there were a bunch of seeds that fell out of it.
Weed seeds. Yeah, my parents said it was for growing grass, like for my lawn, right? This is lawn seed. Yeah. So this is kind of a weird one. This is a weird one. Okay, the My Way karaoke curse, right? In the karaoke world, no other song spells out certain doom other than Frank Sinatra's My Way. At least, that's the way it seems in the Philippines. my second home, my second country. So many people have passed there after singing that song that it has its own crime category, right? Some say it's because the song's popularity mixed with the aggressive atmosphere at the karaoke clubs, and it's not the song itself that leads to so many issues. Either way, karaoke bars aren't taking any chances and have pulled My Way from all the big blue binders. That's crazy. You know that became like one of those urban legends in the Philippines, and it spread like wildfire. It probably happened once. They were like, hey. So let me see. Anyhow, my sister gave, Moxsmith says, my sister gave me many albums with oregano on the inside. Yeah. Just didn't smell like it. You know about the best new artist Grammy curse, right?
Yeah, there's a bunch of people that were nominated and received the coveted prize of best new artist, only to go into a considerable sophomore slump, many of them never to be heard of again.
Never to be, yeah. Till Tuesday was one of them.
Till Tuesday, I don't know if Till Tuesday, I guess they count. I mean, look, you know, Amy Mann has had a very long career post Till Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah. Play the Hush Hush song. There's a whole story behind that.
Yeah.
Anyway. Legend has it, after the initial rush of attention, winners of the Best New Artist Grammy face nothing but misery, unrelenting pressure to live up to that lofty Grammy standard, poor record sales, and at best, they become a trivia question, or did you know, on the Milk Crates and Turntables podcast. Artists like Milli Vanilli, Men at Work, Jody Watley. I dated a girl in the Philippines that looked just like Jody Watley. Half black, half Filipino. She was hot as fire, but crazier than a sprayed roach. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. No time for you. I never had the patience. Never. As soon as I get the crazy vibe, bye-bye. Bye-bye. I don't care
how hot you are. I find that tremendously interesting that it's you that's calling people crazy.
Well, then that means they must be crazier than me, which isn't good, right? So at least I know. Ooh, yeah. I know my boundaries. Let me see. Yeah, they've all succumbed to that curse. I believe in the 90s you had Jesus Jones was one of those bands.
Right
now, they were done. That was it. They got Best New Artist.
Great song. And my wife loved that entire album, but really never to be heard from again.
No. Nope. They got lost in that whole, like, kind of second British invasion, third. Well, it was more the Manchester scene that made it way over around that time. So I think Jesus Jones got kind of mixed up in all that, and then so that's it. Let's see. Do you ever hear of Jelly Roll Morton?
Sure. Pianist. Okay. Jazz guy.
Yep. New Orleans jazz musician Jelly Roll Morton, a.k.a. Ferdinand Lamente, was said to be under a curse placed upon him by his own godmother, who sold his soul to Satan. His career flourished in the 20s, but one day he discovered a mysterious powder sprinkled around his office, and his career began to flounder. He was so convinced it was due to the curse that he sought out a voodoo woman who told him to burn all his clothing. He did, and the curse appeared to have lifted as his fortune and reputation returned. Yeah.
Got, I love the story with a happy ending.
Yeah, yeah. What about the Lead Belly? Did you ever hear the story of Lead Belly in prison?
Well, it depends which story. That boy was in prison a bunch of times.
So
I love Lead Belly.
Yeah. Yeah, Lead Belly allegedly won his freedom from prison by writing a song for a governor twice.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Huddy Williams Ledbetter, right? Ledbetter received the stage name Lead Belly while he was serving time for one of his two prison sentences. During his first sentence, Lead Belly was convicted of slaying a relative. He had tried to escape prison, but after a failed attempt, he allegedly decided to become a model inmate in the hopes he would find a way out of the jail through good behavior. Lead Belly's chance came when he was tasked to sing for a Texas governor, Pat Neff, on numerous occasions. Being smart, he capitalized on this stroke of good fortune, and Lead Belly composed a song that he would frequently sing to the governor, begging for a pardon and release. After a year of singing to the governor, Lead Belly was granted a full pardon and released from prison. But as it would go, 5 years later, Lead Belly again found himself in jail due to a stabbing incident. It's alleged that Lead Belly was released from prison the second time because he again wrote a song and sang it to a different governor requesting his release. Fuck. Oh,
pretty crafty.
That's pretty crafty. Fucking crafty is right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy shit.
But then, you know, old Lead Belly, you know, he ended up on stage at Carnegie Hall. He had a very prolific career. He actually recorded a couple of children's albums.
Wow. That's a good, did you know?
Yeah.
That's a good, did you know? They made a movie about him back. I think it was in the 70s. 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a very good movie, unfortunately.
I didn't think so. Yeah. I've never tried to watch it because I remember the previews didn't seem. It was one of those, maybe it was a blaxploitation movie. I don't know. Just didn't seem to kind of, I was like, I'm not going
to
watch
it. You should go back and listen to some of his music, like Grey Goose and Midnight Special and Goodnight Irene, you know, Gallows Pole. There's a bunch of stuff that he's done. Fantastic. Yeah. Right. Love Lead Belly.
There you go. Did you know that Graham Nash wrote Just a Song Before I Go on a $500 bet?
I did not know that.
Yeah, released in 77, Just a Song Before I Go was, you know, one of their biggest hits. It was their biggest hit. But Graham Nash never would have written it if not for an off-the-cuff remark by his weed-slinging friend. He told the Daily Press, I was in Maui. And I had an hour to kill before I had to catch my plane. I was staying with a friend who was a low-end level drug dealer, you know, weed, nothing too dark. And he said to me, you're supposed to be a big shot songwriter. Bet you can't write a song just before you go. I asked him how much he wanted to bet. He said $500. Nash wrote the 2-minute song in a stream of consciousness style and allegedly didn't change a note when he and the band finally recorded it. As to whether or not his friend paid up, he said, quote, I still have his $500.
That's awesome.
Pretty fucking cool. That stream of consciousness, when you're asking a creative mind like that, you know, I'm sure like comedians get into that stream of consciousness and it's just a zone that you get in, right? And he pumped that out and he's like, we're recording this. And they were like, but no, we're recording this. And they went, okay. Okay, what the hell? Why not? Before joining Kiss, did you know Vinnie Vincent wrote the soundtracks for Happy Days and Joni Loves Chachi?
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that true?
It is true. I saw a thing on, I read an article the other day. It was an interview with, I believe it was about Vinnie Vincent when he was with Kiss. And he joined the band and they were like, good, we got this guitar player. But slowly, his guitar solos started getting longer and longer and started to drag out. And the band didn't like it too much. They started kind of saying, nah, but he kept doing it like the look at me thing. And he would do these drawn out guitar solos. And eventually they were like, yeah, you got to go. Enough's enough.
Yeah, he wasn't with them very long.
No, no. But he said in an interview, he said, I wouldn't change a thing. You know, there's like a video of him that they said it's one of the only ones that somebody got. It's on YouTube. I went and looked at it. And it is this long twanging, you know, down on your knees. You go to see Kiss. You're not going to see. You know, it was almost like hairband before hairband metal. But let's see. Let's get one more. Let's get one more. The Gloomy Sunday Curse. Ever hear of the Gloomy Sunday Curse?
No.
All right. So it says, can a song be so sad and depressing that it encourages people to end their lives? What's the most depressing song you've ever heard?
I think I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry by Hank Williams is a pretty depressing song.
All right.
let's see. It's a Motherfucker by the Eels is a pretty depressing song. Did you have one in mind?
No. I was just curious. Taps is a depressing song.
Yeah.
That's the most depressing song. Anyways, the song in question. Yeah. The song in question is by Hungarians Rez Sures and Ladislas Yavor. And it was written about Sures's girlfriend who took her own life. When it was released in 1933, authorities reported a rise in people taking their lives and promptly banned it from being played nationwide. It was also recorded by Paul Robeson and Billie Holiday in 1941. Each time it was released, it was held responsible for an uptick in untimely passings.
So you just because you mentioned her, how about you talk about depressing songs? How about Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday? Holy Moses.
Yeah. She probably had some. Hey, so I'm not going to do any trivia this week because, well, we just gave out a lot of trivia. So I'm going to give you this top 10 this week in 1999. Can you name a song from 1999?
From 1999. Let's see. How about I Want to Soak Up the Sun by Sheryl Crow?
Okay, I believe you. I don't even know. Number 10 this week, the week of November 1st. Steal My Sunshine by Len, which is it's a good one-hit wonder with a lick from a disco song. It was number 10. Number 9, We Can't Be Friends by Deborah Cox. Number 8, Back at One by Brian McKnight. Number 7, My Love Is Your Love by Whitney Houston, the late great. Number 6, I Need to Know by Mark Anthony. Number 5, Unpretty by TLC. Number 4, Mambo Number 5 by
Lou Bega.
There you go. Let's see. Number 3, Heartbreaker by Mariah Carey featuring Jay-Z. Number 2, Satisfy You, Puff Daddy featuring R. Kelly. Sure he regrets that one. And number 1 this week in 1999, Smooth, Santana featuring the Rob Thomas. Anyway.
Rob Thomas.
Exactly.
Rob Thomas and that famous band Matchbox 20. Rob Thomas and those other guys.
Yeah, our friend Dave Phillips loves them. Yeah.
Who does?
Dave Phillips, the king of the 45s.
Oh, God.
Yeah, he loves, he loves, what do they call it? What's the name of that group?
Matchbox 20.
Matchbox 20, yeah, he loves them, man. Yeah. So, hey, you know what happened on this day in 1967?
The Beatles played.
No, that would have been a good guess. Trust me. It might even be in here somewhere. I don't know. But it's always a good shot that has something to do with the Beatles. Like you said, it's either the Beatles, Elvis, or the Rolling Stones. The
Beatles and the Rolling Stones met Elvis for the first time in 1967.
On this day in 1967, one of the greatest rock albums, maybe, Cream released the second studio album, Disraeli Gears, right?
Pretty good.
It's a pretty good album, which became the group's breakthrough, becoming a massive seller in 68 and reaching number 4 on the American charts. The album features the two singles, Strange Brew and Sunshine of Your Life, and Ginger Baker was the greatest drummer ever. That's what I
heard. Sunshine of Your Love, not life.
Sunshine of Your Love, yeah, I jumped by it, yeah. See what happens when I'm trying to rush. On this day in 1982, Mark Smith says he had his fourth beer ever. It was wild.
Wow.
He's a crazy dude, isn't he? Oregano and beer.
And brain salad surgery. There's a recipe to be alone for the rest of your life.
Jack, what were you doing on this day in 1982? Any day in 1982.
I know I wasn't home.
Exactly.
I know time. I didn't have any oregano on me.
Exactly. On this day in 1969, Creedence Clearwater Revival released Willie and the Poor Boys, the third studio album that the band released in a year. The album features the songs Down on the Corner, from which the album got its name, Fortunate Son, which is a well-known protest song, and their version of the Lead Belly song, Cotton Fields. See how that crossed over? Yeah. On this day in 1974, George Harrison, this is a did you know, became the first Beatle to undertake a solo world tour when he played the first show of a 30-night tour in Vancouver. He was like, I'm busting out.
I thought for sure that I was going to get to see George. So George, when his last tour he did with Eric Clapton, and they did like Japan, like I guess the Far East. And Eric was trying to convince him, let's bring this to the United States. And George was like, nope, had enough.
Yeah, no doubt. Another good album was released on this day in 1978. The Police released their debut album, Orlando Steer Moore. The working title was Police Brutality, which was changed to make it sound more romantic. The title loosely translates as Outlaws of Love. But the term Orlando...
That was a good move. Police Brutality would have been a terrible name for that, right?
Yeah. But the term Orlando is actually a mix of words from outlaws and commandos, elevated by the success of its lead single, Roxanne. Orlando Steer Moore peaked at number 6 on the UK album charts and at number 23 in the United States. The album spawned 2 additional hit singles, Can't Stand Losing You and So Lonely. Do you have all the color copies?
I do.
I believe I do too. Red, green, and yellow, right?
Yep. Yep. Got them all.
Yep. There you go. A lot of people don't
and probably those. have multiple doubles. Copies of each.
Yeah. Doubles, right? On this day in 1984, the Reverend Marvin Gaye Sr. was sentenced to a suspended 6-year sentence. I never understood that. And probation for the manslaughter of his son, Marvin Gaye. He later died at a nursing home in 98. I guess he was crazy. They just kind of took sympathy on him. On this day in 1991, see, this is when I had no money. This is when I was broke. U2 scored their second UK number one single with The Fly. That's my reference to no money, is I didn't get to see them because I couldn't afford a concert ticket. Taken from their album Achtung Baby, the song was also a showcase for a persona Bono had invented called The Fly. Actually, The Fly. I have a pair of those glasses. I have a pair of fly glasses.
Yes, you do.
Yes, they're pretty cool, man. They're pretty cool. Yeah. The Achtung Baby was a kind of I think it wasn't critically accepted at first, or was it kind of, because they went way off the grid with that one. They got all the like, technotronic stuff. They started introducing different sounds. That was when they
Bono's famous line when people asked him about Achtung Baby, he said it sounded like 4 men chopping down the Joshua tree.
Yeah, it was a totally different, and that was their thing though. And they were brilliant at every album was different. Like
Achtung Baby, Achtung Baby is a great record.
It is. It really is. Record. Wild Horses, right?
Yep.
Who's going to ride your wild horses? Yeah, I mean, that song just that has a memory behind it for a friend.
Come on, Zoo Station. But, you know, even better than The Real Thing. One. There's some great stuff on there.
Wild Horses, Who's Gonna Ride This Wild? It has a special place for a friend of mine who passed away, who I turned him on to U2 in like 90, and he became like a mega fan, you know, opened his whole world up, and that was his favorite song, so I have to say that's, you know, and it's still a great song. The lyrics, all the lyrics on that album were brilliant.
Yeah.
He was just in his prime.
He was.
He was in his prime. Let me see. Mark Smith says, I was in a hostel for a month when Achtung Baby came out. I heard it sans alcohol and traction, and I freaking loved it. Yeah, here you go. He was in the hospital for a month. He was in traction. He was drunk. That's good. He's breaking it. He's showing us a little more. He's slowly coming out.
Yeah.
He also said back a couple, got to hand it to Eric Clapton. He helped many of his friends, wish he could have convinced George to come to the USA.
Yeah. Eric Clapton helped out a lot of his friends. He helped George get out of his relationship with Patty Boyd.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. On this day in 1999, the Foo Fighters released their third studio album, There Is Nothing Left to Lose. The album marks the first appearance of the late, great Taylor Hawkins.
Taylor Hawkins, yep.
Early pressings of the disc included a temporary tattoo similar to the one featured on the album cover. Now, this is kind of interesting. On this day in 2007, Ozzy Osbourne claimed his reputation had been tarnished after a party supposedly involving him was organized by U.S. police officers to round up missing criminal suspects. Over 500 people this. In North Dakota, right? With outstanding arrest warrants were sent invitations and more than 30 suspects turned up. Osbourne said it was insulting that his name had been used, but police argued it was a creative way to fight crime. See, Ozzy was selected because he was due to play a gig at a nearby arena, which was used to explain why he would supposedly be in North Dakota. Hey. I can imagine Ozzy saying, "You stained my reputation.
You stained my reputation."
The guy that pissed on the Alamo. He stained my reputation. On this day in 2015,
yeah, Adele went to... Wait a minute. Yeah, wait a minute. Yeah. He didn't pee on the Alamo in protest. He just had to pee.
Yeah, he didn't know what the fuck it was. You ever seen the Alamo?
Yeah.
It ain't nothing to look at.
It's not much. It's like right in the downtown area.
Yeah, it's not really much to look at.
It's not like going and peeing on the White House.
Yeah, I saw the Alamo and I was like, yeah, I don't blame him. And the Alamo is like the Eiffel Tower, the Empire State Building, and the Grand Canyon. You only have to see it once. It's not going to change.
Although the Grand Canyon will take a while for you to see.
As the great Homer Simpson once said, the Grand Canyon. What a Grand Canyon. Okay, let's go.
So pre 9/11, I was taking a flight back from California. Plane was maybe halfway filled. Never would believe that this would happen. We were flying back. I can't remember if I was coming back from California or like Seattle or something like that. But the pilot came on and said, "We're going to be flying over the Grand Canyon, and I'm going to take the plane so you guys can see it better."
Great.
I mean, like he.
Yeah.
We were pretty low.
Yeah. I hate to see it that bad. I'm sure they do it all the time. It's not like there's a lot of planes. There's helicopters flying around there, though.
Yeah.
Helicopters.
That was cool.
On this day in 2015, Adele went to number one. You like Adele?
Sure.
Yeah. I used to drive my stepdaughter crazy. I'd call her Adelaide.
Yeah. Adele is, you know, I put Adele in, you know, the category of like, you know, Dido or, and I'm not saying that they're at the same level. Oh. You know, Beyonce.
What's her name? The one that the guy that played the sitar with the Beatles.
Nora Jones.
Yeah, Nora Jones in that category.
Nora Jones. I personally like Nora Jones a lot better than I like Adele.
I do too.
Just because she's a little jazzier, and I just think that she has an amazing voice. I mean, I think that music is fine. I wouldn't go like way out of my way to go see Adele. But if a bunch of friends were going and whatnot, or if it was on, it's fine.
Well, the song went to number one in the U.S. singles chart. Hello, right? The lead track from a third album.
Yeah, great song.
Became the first song to sell more than 1 million digital copies in a single week and the third highest weekly sales total since Nielsen SoundScan began tracking sales in 1991.
Yeah. I believe it. Adele's great. I mean, she's very, very talented, you know?
Yeah. On this day in 2018, the widow of Soundgarden singer Chris Cornell was suing his doctor, accusing him, Chris Cornell, by the way, greatest voice of his generation, accusing him of overpricing drugs, overprescribing drugs, that ultimately led to his death in 2017. Vicky Cornell alleged that Dr. Robert Coblin negligently and repeatedly prescribed the singer dangerous mind-altering controlled substances. Cornell was found in a Detroit hotel room. His death was ruled as a suicide. Suffered from some severe depression, I guess, too.
I wonder if she won that suit.
I don't know. So she filed it in 2018, so it could still be going on.
Yeah, very well could be.
I'm sure COVID probably shut it down. Hey, born on this day. We're almost done, Jack.
Jesus Christ.
Born on this day in celebration of our friend, my buddy, my friend, my sometimes compadre on the Milk Crates and Turntables show, Mark Smith, that crazy guy. And born on this day was Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
I wonder why Mark was in traction. Do you know what happened?
No. That would be interesting. Probably got hit by a car. I don't know why I'd say that. I'm just guessing.
Well, you know, knowing a little bit about Mark Smith, I think
we're going to get an answer.
I don't think he was hit by a car. I think a car hit him.
There is a difference. There is a difference. That's a great observation. Car accident, and I was not drinking. That's what you said on the police report.
Yeah.
I was not. Hey, born on this day in 1961, kind of a one-hit wonder, but very talented girl, Catherine Dawn Lang, otherwise known as Katie Lang.
Wow.
Born on this day in 1965. Awesome. Hey, Constant Craving is a great song. That's one of those songs I can never turn off.
Yes, it's a great song.
It's a great video.
It's just a wonderful fact. I'm just so thrilled that I've stuck around the show to hear that.
Even better than her, born on this day in 1965, Bobby Dahl, the Poison bassist. And finally, born on this day in 1979, the hip-hop artist, rap artist, Nelly. With Country Grammar, that's a great rap song. That's a great song. And that's it, buddy.
All right. Goodbye.
See you later. Get off my show. Go. Just go. I don't need you. Get off my show. Anyways, he's gone. He froze up. Yeah, he's got that New Hampshire internet connection. Just in the nick of time, his bars go red, which is good. I don't care. I don't need him to say, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. We always truly appreciate it. Remember, you are the engine that runs this machine. Without you, I'd just be talking to Jack about music. And listening to Mark Smith tell us stories about how he wasn't drinking when he got in a car accident and was put in traction back in the 80s and all sorts of other good stuff. I even forgot what the fuck I was just saying. I fucked my whole outro up. Anyways, yeah, thanks for listening. Like I always say, doing this show for you guys, to quote my favorite artist, Morrissey, the pleasure, the privilege is mine. And we will be back next week. Maybe I'll bring Mark Smith on to explain his car accident. I don't know. And Perry, thanks for showing up. Perry Dedovich. And Lou Colicchio wasn't on board tonight watching, but listen to the Music Relish podcast. Those guys know what they're talking about. That's why I got them on my show. They're a godsend. Anyways, have a great week. See you next week.